by sheer ferocity, prevent it from enfolding her into oblivion. She was like a siren on night reefs, singing ships to their wreckage, and her enticing song appealed to some part of Henry that he didn't understand, to a secret second heart that beat a tempo different from his first, and that held within its throbbing chambers a blackness darker than death. He knew the blue stucco house with the white metal roof, and even in his current condition, he knew how to get there. For now, he had forgotten the boy, and the conscience that wasn't a conscience could no longer control him. The female voice was irresistibly alluring, calling to some self-destructive aspect of Henry Lorimar. But it was also savage and so venomous that he might need a weapon. He pulled the car off the road long enough to get a combination long-handled lug-wrench pry bar from the SUV's toolkit. Chapter 3. Two dirt ruts, stubbled with dead weeds, led past the abandoned blue stucco house and the ragged queen palms, past the yard of pea gravel and specimen cacti. Luther drove around behind the place and parked beside the attached one-car garage, which shielded the Chevy Suburban from the sight of anyone passing on the county highway.
"Come civilian, leave official," Luther said. "Still the plan?"
"I don't see any reason to change it. It's been smooth so far, but maybe not much longer. You know what to do."
"I know what to do," he agreed. "Go to your boy."
She walked along the weedy driveway for about 70 or 80 yards to a turnaround in front of the dilapidated barn, which she knew was not only what it appeared to be. The hot desert air vibrated with the sawing of insects that busied their bowstring legs, cars buzzing past on the distant county road, and an airplane whisking the day with turboprop blades. An aircraft had droned past when they were unhitching the Suburban from the motorhome. Maybe this was the same one, seeking to sane her voice and location from the sky when she used a burner phone. She stood before the weathered man-sized door with its worm-eaten, sun-split boards and rusted hinges, looking up where Gavin Washington had told her a concealed camera would be focused on her. Hidden motion detectors had alerted Cornell Jasperson to her presence. The electronic lock opened with a buzz and a clunk. Jane stepped into a white-walled vestibule where a camera surmounted a metal door. The door behind her closed automatically, and the one before her opened. Lamp-lit in jewel tones, shadowy in places, lined with thousands of colorful spines, before her lay the fabled library for the end of the world, as magical as Gavin had described it. At some distance stood Cornell, almost 7 feet tall, knob-jointed like a mechanical construct, misshapen, a figure of fright on a dark street, but with the face of an angel, awkward and clearly shy. Nearer stood Travis, utterly still, as if he thirsted for the sight of her and could not move until his thirst was slaked. She saw in this precious boy not just her child, but the best of herself and the best of her beloved husband. She saw the most cherished part of her past, too, all the years of happiness with Nick, and her future in its entirety, for there could be no future worth having if Travis wasn't in it. When they weren't together, she thought of him as bigger than he was, perhaps because she had all of her heart and hope invested in this boy. And in spite of her dire situation, her hope was no little thing. Now, he seemed so much smaller and more fragile than she remembered, vulnerable and as easily taken from her as Nick had been, as her mother had been. She approached him and dropped to her knees, and he flew into her arms, clutching her with something like desperation. The dogs whined, seemed to debate the proper protocol, and settled on the floor to comfort each other. Just then, neither Jane nor Travis felt a need to speak. The substance of him, the warmth of him, the sweetness of his breath, The rabbit thump of his heart as he pressed against her were worth more than all the words in this vast library. She kissed the top of his head, kissed his brow, and when he put one small hand to her face, she kissed the fingers, the palm. The words "love you" passed between them, the only words that seemed important enough to speak, though by speaking them, Travis lost his composure. Tears flooded his eyes, and he revealed that even at his age, he held no illusions about the fate of his former guardians, the Washingtons, though he had concealed his certainty until now.
"They're gone. Aunt Jess and Uncle Gavin, we're never going to see them again. They would have come back by now. They're dead. Aren't they dead, Mommy?"
When they had gone on the run from their house in Virginia, he'd begun calling her Mom, as if aware that he needed to grow up faster than nature intended. Sunday night, when she took a call from him on her burner phone, he'd reverted to Mommy. Now again. She had many reasons to hate the people aligned against her, these arrogant, self-named techno-Arcadians, not least of all because they took her boy's father from him, but also because they stole his innocence. They forced on him an awareness of the darkness of this world that he otherwise would have discovered slowly over the years, with his parents' guidance, in a manner that would have made it easier for him to come to terms with the harder truths of life. On Sunday, speaking with him on the phone, she'd thought Travis feared that Jesse and Gavin had been killed, but she had seen no compelling reason to confirm his fear, not while he was feeling so vulnerable, not while she was hundreds of miles away from him and could not take him in her arms. He was in her arms now, and among the many things she owed him was the truth. She knew from hard experience that too little truth in any family led to enduring pain. If her mother had not concealed the serious marital problems between her and Jane's father, if the great pianist Martin Duroc had known his daughter was aware of his affair and might testify to her mother's distress, perhaps he would not have dared to kill one wife to get another. "Yes, sweetie. Jesse and Gavin are gone. They were very brave. They were very brave all their lives, and they loved you as if you were their own child." His voice was thick, tremulous, choked with tears.
"What can we do? What can we do?"
She held him tight and rocked with him there on the floor. "We can remember them always, sweetheart. Never forget how brave they were, how wonderful and kind and giving and funny. We can love them always, and every night in our prayers we can say thanks for having had them in our lives." He spoke into her throat, which was wet with his tears.
"It's not enough. They won't know."
"But they will know, honey. They will know every night. They will hear you every night, and they will know you loved them as much as they loved you." Her grief was now doubled by his grief. She wondered how many heartbreaks a child so young could endure. Chapter 4. Cornell stood by one of his favorite armchairs, in the warm golden light of his prettiest stained glass floor lamp, surrounded by the consolation of his books, and he knew no comfort, only misery. He could not bear the boy's grief, the tears. He wanted to do something to soothe this child, comfort him, but there was nothing he could do. He dared not hug Travis as the mother did. A mere hug would plummet Cornell into an anxiety attack, and he would be no good to anyone. A big, strange, ugly man curled in the fetal position and shaking with fear, unable to stand, hardly able to speak, a burden to them, not a comfort. He stood wringing his large hands, ceaselessly shifting his weight from one foot to the other, as if he needed to go someplace at once but didn't know where. He had long been at peace with his limitations, at peace with the hard road that was his only route through life. But he was not at peace now. He did not remember ever having wept before, but he was weeping. Chapter 5. The desert was new to Luther Tillman, and he liked it about as much as he might like being forked onto a barbecue and broiled over charcoal. He had known hotter days than this, even in his home state of Minnesota, but there was something about the pale sky and the dry air and the dusty trees and the mostly barren earth that intensified the effect of the heat and, for him anyway, made 90 degrees significantly more oppressive here than it would have been in a different landscape. He shrugged out of his black denim jacket. He considered taking off his shoulder rig, but under the current circumstances, he would feel more naked without the pistol than if he stripped out of all his clothes. The gear in the back of the Chevy Suburban included a 40-foot garden hose with a special nozzle and two identical 1-quart bottle-like attachments, each filled with a custom-mixed solvent that fed their contents into the water stream in a continuous, measured flow. He found the hose bib at the corner of the garage where Jane had been told it would be, tested the water pressure, and hooked up the hose. The white paint was a special blend that Enrique DeSoto had concocted and applied in Nogales. The solvent turned the paint to something like chalk, and the water washed it off, leaving the factory-applied black paint intact. There were also three large white block letters on the roof of the vehicle, the same three repeated on the front doors, FBI, and these letters likewise were impervious to the solvent. Come civilian, leave official. Once they had the boy, they didn't want to risk being stopped by authorities between here and the motorhome in the RV park. If a roadblock was encountered, an FBI vehicle could more likely be driven around it without being forced to stop. Like some alchemist of ages long past, Luther washed the white Suburban to black, while the sun, in a far less magical fashion, beat on his shaved head and glazed his face with sweat. Chapter 6. In the corner where shadows drift around and over you, there is no passage of time, for you know not time, but only the eternal now. There is hunger in the now, fear, hatred. Hatred of all that is not you, anything that is not you is a potential threat. You are awake, eyes open, but dreaming. Dark dreams darkle down into ever deeper darkness. In the now is desire, but only of the most primitive kind, for food, for prey, for violence that conquers threat and fills your mouth with the nourishing blood of the other. Within your head, whispers come, whispers go, words as meaningless as wind in dry grass or rat's feet over broken glass. Emotions come, sent by others. Their fear and hatred inspire greater fear and hatred of your own. Images of violence occurring elsewhere in the now, prey being slashed, beheaded, gutted, the rutting frenzy of others mounting their prey before they kill it. Such images stir passions of your own, passions as cold as they are intense, but always fear endures, even in passion. I will show you fear in a handful of dust. A sudden sound injects new fear into the now. A familiar sound, yet you cannot name it or imagine its source. The word engine passes repeatedly through your mind but means nothing to you, and by its very meaninglessness further irritates. You uncoil from the corner, weave upright in shadows, stand listening. Move through shadowy spaces into a space with more light, to a clear shape through which light falls. Others are here. A female moves away through dead weeds toward a big place shaped dark against the day. Nearer is a large white object that stirs in you a memory of moving effortlessly fast, fast, faster, through varied landscapes. These memories are confusing, disturbing, but fragile. They dissolve in a fog of forgetfulness. What remains is a certainty that this white object is the source of the sound that drew you from the corner where you coiled. A male other is busy at this source of the sound. The male is not aware of you. You stand to one side of this clear shape through which light falls, so you can't be easily seen. You watch the male. You watch. A thing happens that excites you. Water gushes, arcs, and the white object becomes black. Day becomes night. White becomes black. But no one makes day into night. Day makes itself into night. This male other frightens you. Can he make day into night? Can he wash away the light forever? Such power terrifies you. No cure for fear except rage, and rage seething into fury. You look around in growing desperation. Urgent, urgent. Things you grip pull open other things, revealing spaces within. Spaces full of familiar items, but you have no names for them, can imagine no purpose for them. Until you find the space full of sharp things. A row of sharp things. You know what to do with one of these. Yes, you know just what to do. Chapter 7. Carter Jurgen is certain that he and DuBose will find Minette Butterworth, wild and naked, within 5 minutes of driving into the barrens behind the Attlee family's wrecked house. That expectation is not fulfilled. These sun-hammered wastes don't offer many places to hide. Here and there, a zigzagging declivity has been cracked into the land by an earthquake. A few shallow washes mark the paths of flash floods that on rare occasions overwhelm the Anza Borrego with tarantula-drowning downpours. The desert scrub is too sparse to provide cover. An occasional cluster of trees, perhaps sustained by an artesian well within reach of their roots, might conceal a woman who'd gone through the forbidden door and fallen into a psychological abyss, but none of them does. In this part of the valley, houses are far apart. In her new incarnation, however, the former Minette Butterworth seems to be as fast as an instinctive predator. She might have homed in on another residence and made it to that cover in a few minutes. When Jurgen pictures her, and others like her, bursting in on an unsuspecting family, the catastrophe underway abruptly expands to terrifying dimensions in his imagination. Unable to find any sign of the feral woman in the open desert, they now need to move from house to house, seeking the place and the people she might at this moment be destroying. As he returns to the county highway and pilots the Velociraptor down valley, DuBose holds forth, as though for a rapt audience. Like the girls whose pasts and personalities are flushed out of them so they can be remade into eager sex toys for the Aspasia clubs. Those men transformed into Rayshaws for security duty have no more inner life than machines. Raymond Shaw is the brainwashed assassin in the Manchurian Candidate. When the late Bertold Schenck created brain-screwed and programmed men to serve as obedient and fearless security agents at his gated estate in Napa, the great scientist thought it was amusing to call them Rayshaws. Except for their expressionless faces and a disturbing deadness in the eyes, they are able to pass for normal, neatly dressed, quiet, eerily polite. They are more focused on their duties than even the most highly trained, dedicated, and fearless bodyguards could ever be. When a threat to their master manifests, they are swift and brutal in response, for they harbor no slightest compunction about killing any trespasser. As DuBose waxes on about the viciousness of Rayshaws and their incapacity for doubt or remorse, Jurgen finally interrupts. "And your point is what?" "My point, cubby, is that I've thought the last thing I would ever want would be to have a gladiator moment with a Rayshaw as my opponent. But having seen what Ramsay Corrigan did to his family, and what our fair Minette did to her husband, old Lucky Bob, I'd go toe-to-toe with any Rayshaw before I'd want to be locked in a room with that bitch and no weapon but my bare hands. A Rayshaw is just a meat machine with sophisticated programming,
But she's something else altogether. She's a slaughtering zombie, purely demonic.
Jurgen suspects that DuBose is playing some stupid Princeton sport with him, some psychological game intended to maneuver him into a panic room of the mind so that he will say something that can be mocked. Nevertheless, he asks, if she's a purely demonic slaughtering zombie, then why are we being so dumb that we're chasing her?
Because such is our fate, Cubby. A man can't escape his fate, especially not men like us. Dedicated revolutionaries who have bound over our fortunes to the cause, reaching for the brass ring of total power, knowing that if we miss it, we will be destroyed, crushed, and thrown away as if we never lived. Such is the hard bargain we made with destiny, a bargain few men have the courage to make.
Exasperated by this grandiose speechifying, Jurgen says, well, I don't see myself at all that way. DuBose turns upon Jurgen a smile of genteel pity.
I know you don't, Cubby. That's why from time to time I give you these little pep talks, to encourage you to better understand yourself and the heroic enterprise on which you're embarked.
Chapter 8. Travis had his bags packed and standing by, but as it turned out, Cornell Jasperson had packed a bag too. Like a benign gargoyle that had come alive and climbed down from its high perch on some gothic building, the big man stood before Jane in a beseeching posture. He swayed from side to side, scuffing the floor with his shoes, holding his hands against his chest, as though to contain the hope in his heart for fear it would escape him.
I need to go with the boy, please and thank you. I need to go with the boy. I need to go with him. The boy.
Jane had known that Travis could not be asked to abandon the dogs, in spite of the difficulty they would pose during any escape from Borrego Valley. He had lost too much already. He had no doubt felt guilty about Gavin and Jesse, though he had no responsibility for the sacrifice they had willingly made. Even though he had known Duke and Queenie for only a few months, the bonds between a boy and his dogs were such that, after what he had already been through, forcing him to leave the German shepherds behind would break something in him that might never be repaired. She'd made preparations for the dogs, but not for a gentle giant with a personality disorder who couldn't be touched without suffering a disabling anxiety attack.
I'm pretty sure I can be a better burden, said Cornell. What I meant to say is a better person. If you take me with you, I'm pretty sure I'll betray well, behave well.
Whether they had conspired in this beforehand or not, Travis was instantly on board with Cornell's request.
We have to take him with us, Mom. Me and Mr. Jasperson, we're going to Atlanta someday to see them bottle Coca-Cola.
The last couple days, said Cornell, the dogs touched me, but I always pretended like they didn't, pretended really hard, and so I didn't have an attack. Then, after a while, I didn't need to pretend anymore.
He reached down to touch one of the shepherds, and the big dog wagged its tail.
You gotta let him come, Travis pleaded. He makes really good sandwiches and the best muffins ever. He's got a Fipoline recipe for pineapple coconut muffins, and he made them all millionaires.
Not the muffins, Cornell explained. I made the Filipino workers all millionaires. I can't touch people because I'm a full-on planter's nut bar that way. But I can take good care of the dogs.
He looked down at his feet, as shy as a child, then raised his eyes to Jane once more.
Besides, if I stay here, sooner or later the bad people will come for me. Won't they come for me?
He was right. They would figure out where Travis had been kept, and they would take Cornell into custody, if for no other reason than to bleed him of his fortune. She said, "We don't leave the wounded behind. Somehow we'll fit you in.
He reads aloud better than anyone,
Travis assured her with a note of desperation.
And he was real nice about the toothbrush.
Relax, cowboy, she said. It's already decided. You two wait here with the dogs. I'll go see how Luther's doing, and we'll bring the Suburban over here to load up. Chapter 9. It was a slow day in the convenience store. Bipin Gaitonde, born in Bombay but a proud citizen of the desert for 17 years, husband of Zoya, father of three, enterprising entrepreneur, attended the cash register in his store when customers were present, and when he was alone, he busied himself replenishing the candy racks. He had just come out of the stockroom with a carton of Payday bars when the Cadillac XT5 exploded through the big front window. A fierce horizontal rain of glittering bits of glass sleeted through the store, followed by a storm of cheese doodles shot from bursting bags. Potato chips expelled from their ruptured packages were cast through the air like a barrage of martial arts throwing stars. Insanely, the motorist accelerated upon entrance. The first row of displays came apart and toppled noisily into aisle two, and the Cadillac began to surmount the broken shelves and all the scattered merchandise. Bipin dropped the paydays. He leaped out of the way, scrambled onto the cashier's counter. The vehicle came to a halt mid-store, canted on rubble, two tires punctured, its windshield dissolved. Veils of steam rose around the edges of its buckled hood. The driver forced open his door and bulled his way out of the caddy, pressing aside parts of a shattered display, kicking angrily at obstructing packages of national brand cupcakes and cream-filled baked goods that Bipin found tasteless but that sold well. He knew this man. Buckley Tolbert, founder of Heart of Home, the oldest restaurant in Borrego Springs. 60-something, white-haired, sweet-faced, soft-spoken Bucky Tolbert was a friend to everyone, generous and amusing. Getting out of the Cadillac, Bucky fired off a fusillade of uncharacteristic vulgarities and obscenities, filth exploding from him like bullets from a machine gun. Crouched atop the cashier's counter, Bipin Gaitonde was shocked by those indecencies. Although he sold certain risque magazines in his store, he displayed them in plain paper sleeves that revealed only the name of the publication and prevented the magazine from being opened until it was purchased and removed from the premises. "Mr. Tolbert," Bipin admonished, "do you not hear yourself?" As though he became aware of Bipin only then, the restaurateur began peppering his salty language with vicious threats, primarily involving Bipin's emasculation. In spite of his age, and though as a hazard of his occupation he weighed perhaps 40 pounds too much, Buckley Tolbert clambered over the wreckage, crossing the store and coming toward Bipin with the alacrity and grace of a mountain lion. Once an ardent hiker, Bipin had been high in the San Bernardino Mountains 5 years earlier when, late in the afternoon, he turned a bend in the trail and saw a 400-pound mountain lion leap from an upslope stand of pines onto the back of an unsuspecting deer. The big cat drove its prey to the ground and tore out its throat before Bipin had the presence of mind to start shaking with terror. He had not gone hiking since that day. Now, it seemed as if some god of lions had descended to the earth and had come to Bipin in an avatar that had once been Buckley Tolbert. Reflections of the store's flickering lights flashed in Tolbert's eyes. The man's face flushed and twisted with such insane fury that it seemed his rage alone ought to pop a cerebral artery or torture his aging heart into cardiac arrest. Bipin realized, almost too late, that he was the deer in this scenario, not entirely unsuspecting, but paralyzed by disbelief. As Buckley Tolbert approached the cashier's station, shrieking now like some venomous spirit liberated from hell, Bipin dropped from the counter into the space behind. He could hardly believe it was necessary to reach for the pistol that he kept on a shelf under the cash register, for he had obtained it to defend against total strangers who might enter the store with armed robbery in mind, which had not yet once happened in quiet Borrego Springs. He had definitely not purchased the gun with the expectation that he would need it to shoot a neighbor and friend, but he grabbed it anyway. Buckley Tolbert vaulted onto the counter and stood up, and Bippin turned with the pistol in hand as his former friend towered over him. Tolbert's white hair stood out from his scalp as if he'd received an electric shock. His eyes were pools of malice. A thick string of snot hung from his nose, quivering like an extruded worm. Blood slicked his chin and circled his mouth, glistened on his lips, and misted on his exhalation when he hissed fiercely between his clenched and blood-stained teeth. Somehow, Bipin Gaitonde knew that this blood was not Tolbert's, that it was evidence of an unthinkable attack on someone else before he had crashed his Cadillac into the convenience store. In the same instant, Tolbert plunged from the counter, and Bippin fired. The big man fell past him, snaring a fistful of Bippin's hair and pulling him off his feet. They landed, with Bippin on top. Although the space behind the counter was narrow, Tolbert rolled them and achieved the superior position, maybe wounded or maybe not. Bippin still gripped the pistol in his right hand, but that arm was under him, crushed between him and the floor. Pain coursed from shoulder to wrist. Under his attacker's bulk, he could draw only shallow breaths into his compressed lungs. With inhuman strength, Tolbert, this thing that had been Tolbert, pinned Bippin's left arm to the floor, incapacitating him. He lowered his florid face close to Bippin's face, spraying him with spittle and blood. His left hand scraped at his captive's brow, the fingers curved into a claw, and Bippin had no doubt that Tolbert was going to take his eyes. He thought of his wife, Zoya, and their children being left alone in this dark world. The horror of failing them gave him the strength to heave up, not violently enough to throw Tolbert off, but enough to free his trapped right arm, in which the nerves were hot wires conducting a disabling pain through muscle and bone. Maybe his arm was broken. Maybe he couldn't grip the gun. But it was not broken. As he brought up the weapon, he fired, and the shot took off a piece of his attacker's left ear. Howling, Tolbert flinched back, clamping his hands over both ears, as though for an instant he couldn't tell which of them was bullet-torn. Recoil almost denied Bippin the pistol, but he held the weapon now in a two-hand grip. At a range of mere inches, he shot Tolbert in the face, once, twice. The attacker fell to the right, mouth open in a silent scream, the architecture of his face remodeled by the double blast, his hair on fire from the muzzle flash. Bippin sat up and frantically scooted backward on the vinyl tile floor until a wall of the wraparound cashier's station prevented further retreat. He struggled to his feet and stood with the pistol in both hands, arms fully extended, as though Tolbert's resurrection and a renewed assault were a matter not of if, but when. At 35, Bippin Gaitonde had never before raised a hand against another human being. When he bought the pistol, Zoya had smiled and said that he was too gentle ever to use it, so empathetic that he would sympathize with a robber in need and not only give him all the cash in the register, but also offer to write a check. Weeping quietly, he stood over the dead restaurateur and did not look up from the corpse until a siren shrilled. It was a rare sound in Borrego Springs. He turned his attention toward the shattered front window, but he didn't expect the imminent arrival of the police. Intuitively, he knew this. The madness that had burst into his store was something new in the world, Hydra-headed and already manifesting elsewhere. Chapter 10. The day was the same as it had been before Jane went into the library for the end of the world. Hot, dry, still, with the faintest alkaline smell to the air, the signature scent of a true desert. Unseen insects were engaged in a monotone celebration of life, and in the distance, a low-flying twin-engine airplane sought cell phone revelations that she was not foolish enough to provide. In spite of the sameness of the day then and the day now, she'd gone only a few steps from the dilapidated barn when that intuitive perception of things seen and unseen told her change had come. The degree of risk had risen. Time was running out. She halted, alert for threats, scanning the day more carefully. Luther was finishing the transformation of the Suburban from white to black. The solvent provided by Ricky DeSoto appeared to be worth the outrageous price he placed on it. If something had gone wrong, if a crisis was impending, Luther seemed unaware. His years in law enforcement and his intelligence had left him with intuition no less sharp than hers. So if he was unconcerned, perhaps she was just jumpy, more worried mother now than calculating cop. Yes, but Luther was handling the hose, and the water that sluiced the white paint from the Suburban drummed loudly enough to mask other sounds from him. Intuition was, in part, subconscious perception. What the busy surface of the mind might be too occupied to notice, the quiet inner mind perceived, interpreted. Then it tried to pass along its concern by raising the hairs on the back of your neck or sending a faux centipede down the ladder of your spine. If one of the five senses was compromised, in this case, Luther's hearing, intuition was, to that degree, crippled. A few steps after leaving the barn, perhaps Jane perceived the merest suggestion of the figure in the doorway of the blue stucco house. In any case, she saw it more clearly when she had closed from 70 yards to 50, its full nature undefined in those shadows, but somehow peculiar, and beyond Luther's awareness. She didn't call out to him at once, because he might not hear her. Besides, if the individual on the porch was focused on Luther and not yet aware of Jane, no need to shout and precipitate action. No one lived in the house. Jesse and Gavin would have stayed there with Travis, but they were dead. They must be dead. Jane walked fast, but didn't run. The faster she moved, the more she would call attention to herself in the stranger's peripheral vision. She was 30 or 40 yards from the house when the figure moved out of the doorway, farther onto the porch, and she saw that it was a woman. Not Jesse Washington. A naked woman. The presence of the woman was itself a spanner in the works, but her nudity was so bizarre that she represented some greater crisis, the nature of which Jane couldn't comprehend. Jane was less than 20 yards from the house when the naked woman saw her, which was also when Luther finished washing off the Suburban, killed the water, and dropped the hose. Running now, Jane saw something bright in the woman's hand, maybe a knife, and she drew her pistol and called out, "Luther, the porch!" Surprised, he turned first to Jane, then pivoted toward the unclothed woman. The stranger was indeed holding a butcher knife in her right hand. She backed into the house and closed the door. Luther had drawn his pistol by the time Jane reached him.
"Who the hell?"
"I don't know," she said. "But this means we have to get out of here fast. Change the plates. I'll go inside."
"Shit, no. Not alone."
"There's no time to tag-team her. Change the plates." Ricky DeSoto had supplied them with government license plates. Federal departments wore special plates with prefix codes specific to each. EPA for the Environmental Protection Agency, OEO for the Office of Economic Opportunity, SAA for the United States Senate. And an FBI vehicle should be wearing the prefix J because the Bureau was under the purview of the Department of Justice. Some Bureau vehicles had FBI emblazoned on doors and roofs, though many did not. Calling attention to the Suburban by block lettering it ought to let them slide around roadblocks and through choke points more easily, but the wrong plates would betray them as surely as would bumper stickers proclaiming "cops suck."
"What if she's not alone in there?" Luther worried.
"Seconds count. We don't just have Travis and the dogs now. We're taking Cornell."
"Holy shit."
"Change the plates, but watch your back. Then drive to the barn and load up." She hurried toward the porch steps. Chapter 11. Carter Jurgen feels that the desert, everything and everyone in it, is so alien to normal human experience that it might as well be on a planet in another galaxy. This feeling is further distilled when he and DuBose come across the wrecked vehicles littering the county highway. The first is a cherry-red Honda sedan, turned on its starboard flank, its roof smashed against a roadside retaining wall built to prevent an eroding bluff from washing across the road in a flash flood. For maybe 60 feet leading to the Honda, the pavement is littered with pieces of the vehicle and wads of safety glass. The blacktop is scarred and imprinted with red paint, as if something impacted the car, overturned it, and then shoved it 60 feet before ramming it hard into the wall. Jurgen gets out of the Velociraptor and goes to have a look at the Honda, and comes back and gets into the passenger seat and says,
"Dead woman in there."
"What kind of dead woman?"
DuBose asks. "What do you mean, what kind?"
"Ethnicity, age, appearance, clothing, nature of injuries. In an investigation as complex as the one we've undertaken, Cubby, you just never know what detail may prove to be the little piece of the puzzle that makes sense of the entire picture."
Caucasian, maybe 30, brunette, shorts and a halter top, all busted up.
"Attractive?"
"What?
You're going to hump a corpse now? Get real, my friend. If this is a crime scene and if the girl is attractive, her looks could have something to do with why she was murdered. A former husband, a jealous boyfriend."
"Who is this jealous boyfriend, King Kong? He grabs a Honda and shuffleboards it 60 feet into a wall?"
"Sarcasm does not become you, Cubby. Anyway, we're not here to investigate murders. She might have information we need. Are you sure she's dead? If she isn't, she ought to be."
"Good enough," says DuBose.
They cruise not quite 1 mile before coming upon a Mini Cooper that has somehow been boosted off the pavement and slammed into an oak with such terrific force that its mangled undercarriage is locked tight around the massive, cracked tree trunk, so that the petite vehicle is suspended about 4 feet off the ground. Although he doesn't offer a reason, DuBose will not take his turn getting out of the Velociraptor to have a closer look at the Mini Cooper. Of course, he doesn't want to give Jurgen an opportunity to occupy the driver's seat in his absence. Jurgen returns from the oak tree.
"Mexican, about 25, jeans and a t-shirt, broken arm, at least one broken leg, probably a major spinal injury, exceedingly attractive, I think you'd say."
"I can read through your pathetic deception, my friend. You didn't use a pronoun because you're trying to avoid saying it's a man, as though I'll run to have a look based on exceedingly attractive."
"Maybe you are a reincarnation of Sherlock Holmes after all."
"This Mexican is alive?"
"Probably not for long. Unconscious and fading."
DuBose sighs.
"So we can't question him. And even if he does live, and it's with a major spinal injury, it won't be a high quality of life. Shall we operate by triage rules and hope the next one, if there is a next, will be more useful to us?"
"Works for me."
Half a mile later, around a turn, they discover a big dog bulldog bagger, a motorcycle with wide-swept fairing and saddlebags. Once a sweet machine with a 111 cubic inch V-twin motor, but now just rack and ruin. 80 or 100 feet beyond the big dog, the man who'd been riding it now lies squashed on the pavement as if he's been put through a giant sandwich press. He's obviously been run over several times by a persistent motorist. The tire tracks of the vehicle used in this homicide are imprinted on the pavement in the victim's bodily fluids. Although the sun has already mostly dried the tracks, the pattern is clear enough to allow Radley DuBose to declare portentously,
"Damn big truck."
Chapter 12. Jane, in the kitchen. No cooler here than outside. The old house vaguely scented with dry rot fungus. Pale panes of porch door glass. One pane broken out. Shards on the floor. Hard sunshine slanted through the window above the sink, so precisely defined by the shape of the pane that the light had sharp edges and sliced the shadows at the cut lines. so that they were sharp-edged, too. Dust motes turning slowly in the illumining shaft, shadows billowing in the corners as if monks had here discarded their robes. Black-and-white patterns laid out as though delivering a profound message in geometric forms. The scene reminded her of some old pre-color movie, the title forgotten, in which protagonist and antagonist had faced off in a war-ravaged church. She couldn't remember who died, who lived, or if perhaps no one survived. She stood listening, but there was nothing to hear until she moved, whereupon the old vinyl tile flooring crackled underfoot. Floorboards creaked beneath the vinyl. On the farther side of the kitchen, an open door led to what might be the living room. To her right, a door probably connected the kitchen to the single-car garage. It stood maybe 8 inches ajar. Jane needed her left hand for tasks. Her right arm, the gun arm, was straight out in front of her. She picked up a shard of glass from the floor, a crescent moon-shaped fragment about 4 inches across, and she stood it on its points, the curve propped against the back door. Now, the nearer of the other two doors, hinged to swing away from her. Stand on the side opposite the hinges. Through the 8-inch gap, there was gloom beyond. One dirt-glazed window, like a TV turned to a dead channel, admitted barely enough light to suggest the shape of a vehicle, an SUV. It must be Gavin and Jesse's Range Rover. They'd left it here when they drove Cornell's Honda to the market in town and died there. Quiet in the little garage. She held her breath and listened, and didn't know if the silence she heard was perhaps the woman with the knife holding her breath. She threw the door open. Its corroded hinges rasped. It slammed against the wall in there, and no one responded. Doorways were bad, the worst. She went through low and fast, head and pistol first, from the half-lit kitchen to the darker garage, moving at once to the right, pressing her back against the wall. There was no good way to die, but she had a particular aversion to being stabbed, to the cold intrusion of steel and the vicious twist of the blade. Her heart knocked hard against her breastbone as she reached up and felt the wall and found the switch near the doorframe and clicked on the overhead fluorescent fixtures. No sign of the woman with the knife. A row of cabinets along the front wall, none large enough to be a hiding place for an adult. Drop low for a quick look under the Range Rover. Nothing. No one inside either. The only exterior door in the garage was the big one that accommodated a vehicle. After entering the kitchen with no less caution than she'd left it, she closed the connecting door. She snatched up another fragment of glass and used it as a telltale. When she returned, if the shards weren't as she'd left them, she'd know someone had entered the house and waited in the garage for a chance to surprise her. Beyond the kitchen lay a living room where the front door was secured with a deadbolt. There were as well 2 small bedrooms, 1 bath, and a study. The rooms contained mismatched discount warehouse furniture that Cornell had left behind when he moved to his library and bunker, and all were deserted. The woman couldn't have gone out the front door and engaged the deadbolt behind her. None of the windows were broken or open, and in fact, they all appeared to be painted shut, inoperable. The heat was stifling. Even breathing through her mouth, Jane wasn't as quiet as she wanted to be. In a corner of the study, 1 door remained to be investigated, maybe a closet. She sheltered against the frame, put her left hand on the knob, and hesitated. Her memory worked the image of the naked woman, Medusa massive hair, face at once lovely and horrific, empty of everything except ferocity. A face strangely reminiscent of that Goya painting, Saturn devouring his children, which contained no loveliness whatsoever. The bold nudity, the bloody hands, the knife. This was something new in the world. It was surely related to the work of the Arcadians. But how? Gun arm across her waist, muzzle toward whatever might burst out of this last unknown space. keeping pressure on the trigger. She twisted the doorknob, cast open the door. No response. She dared the doorway and saw splintered boards sway-backed with the weight of time, steps leading down into darkness that seemed impenetrable and final. In houses of this age, in country vulnerable to earthquakes, basements were rare. Studying the dust on the wide landing for signs that someone had recently descended, Jane startled when a loud crash issued from elsewhere in the house, demanding her immediate attention. But there was no lock on the cellar door, and because it opened onto the landing, it couldn't be braced shut from this side. Another crash from the front of the house, the splintering of wood. Maybe the woman with the knife wasn't down there in the dark. Like hell she's not. Maybe she wouldn't come up when Jane was busy elsewhere. Like hell she won't. Jane hurried out of the study as a third crash reverberated through the walls of the small house. Chapter 13. Carter Jurgen is not one to regret his life choices, although now that the revolution has brought him to this desolate ass end of nowhere, he wonders if he should have taken longer than 3 minutes to join the Techno-Arcadians when his Aunt Deirdre had given him an invitation. Charming Aunt Deirdre is his favorite relative, a dazzling intellectual, a self-made businesswoman worth $700 million, childless, and certain to have included him in her will. Now it seems as if he would have been wiser if he had declined her invitation and instead had killed her in some manner that would not have incriminated him. Through the windshield, Jurgen regards the lightweight Toyota pickup that is on its roof beside the highway, crushed, tires blown, and on fire, although the flames are subsiding. A blackened, partly fleshed skeleton hangs upside down in the driver's seat, like a large, charred, melted campfire marshmallow. Radley DuBose places a call to the Desert Flora study group. He asks about the Airbus H-120 that he earlier ordered into the air to search for Minette Butterworth and for signs of chaos related to the people who were brain-screwed the previous night. He inquires if the flight crew of that aircraft might have noticed anything unusual on this length of county highway. Apparently, the helo pilot and co-pilot have reported in excess of a single disturbance, because DuBose does more listening than talking for perhaps 4 minutes. He punctuates the Desert Flora Study Group agent's report with, huh, and really, and shit, and not good, compadre, not good. When DuBose terminates the call, Jurgen says, if together we can devise an accidental death for my Aunt Deirdre, I would split with you what's likely to be a minimum $100 million inheritance, maybe a great deal more. DuBose is disapproving, though not of homicide.
Let's avoid being distracted by such mundane concerns as money, not with the revolution at stake. Do you recall that one of the 50 people injected last night was a Mr. Arlen Hostein?
I've got enough on my mind without having to remember the names of 50 losers.
Arlen Hostein, DuBose says, is the owner of Valleywide Waste Management, the local trash collection firm. He sometimes services one of his company's routes himself when a driver is sick. He seemed a good enlistee in the hunt for the hawk brat. No one thinks twice about a garbage truck pulling up to house after house, so he has a chance to give each place a look over, check trash cans at curbside to see if any contents suggest the presence of a small child in a family that doesn't have kids.
Brilliant, Jurgen says sarcastically.
Not as it has turned out, I'm afraid. Hostein is driving an immense trash collection truck with front-loading arms that can lift the heaviest dumpster with ease. It's like a tank.
So he's gone through the forbidden door, has he? Just like Minette?
He has obviously deteriorated mentally, but evidently not as much as she has. And, by all reports, he's not naked. That's something to be thankful for.
DuBose drives onto the highway once more.
The Airbus crew saw Hostein rampaging,
but they haven't stayed on him because other more disturbing incidents require their attention. More disturbing than Hosteen? How many other incidents? 6. Not to worry. We'll find Hosteen and shut him down. In his garbage truck tank? That won't be easy. You may remember, I met your Aunt Deirdre. Killing Hosteen in his truck will be a lot easier than killing that ball buster.
Chapter 14. Jane, on the move. Heckler in a two-hand grip, just under her line of vision. A short, narrow hall served the bedrooms and study. When she stepped into the living room, she saw that the old, weathered, desiccated front door had cracked loose of its hinges. It hung askew, fixed to the frame only by its deadbolt. Having kicked in the door, a 40-ish man, pale and disheveled and sweating profusely, looking both angry and bewildered, stood just inside the room, maybe 15 feet from her, holding an iron pry bar that had an angled neck and lug wrench at one end. Keeping the heckler's front sight on the intruder, positioned so that peripheral vision might alert her to movement in the hallway to her left, Jane said, "Put it down." He was costumed neither in black leather, nor in a vest made from human nipples, nor with a necklace fashioned from the teeth of his victims, in neither a leather mask nor a hood imprinted with the face from Edvard Munch's painting The Scream, as movies routinely portrayed existential threats like this. He wore a blue and yellow striped polo shirt, white slacks, and white topsiders without socks. A mundane monster for an insipid age when imagination had gone digital and the true horrors of the world were so disturbing that a lot of people found it easier to fear imaginary threats. Ignoring Jane's command, he said,
"Was you? Was you? Is you the bitch? Bitch? The bitch in my head? You?"
He must be on one drug or another, maybe an entire apothecary. His blue eyes were wide and lunatic, yet as clear and alert as the eyes of a hunting owl. Anger contorted his face. Not anger alone, but also perhaps some neurological disorder. Every muscle from his hairline to chin and ear to ear moved not in concert, but in disjunctive arrangements, producing a shifting kaleidoscope of grotesque expressions. Although every look was unnatural in the extreme, they all conveyed rage, hatred, and demented lust. "Put down the crowbar," she repeated. He took one step toward her and raised his voice, loud and menacing.
"Is you? Is you? Is you whisper, sex me, kill you, sex me, kill, kill, whisper inside head?"
The whispering room. He was one of the adjusted people, and something was very damn wrong with his program. Maybe because the pry bar looked almost as long as a Taser XREP 12-gauge shotgun, she thought of Ivan Petro on Monday, coming for her from out of the oak trees. She thought of the hammer with which she'd been pounding the burner phone, of how she hadn't dropped it before drawing her gun, but instead had thrown it. Life was raveled through with inexplicable patterns that could never be understood, but could be recognized by anyone who acknowledged their existence, so Jane knew what this creature was about to do even before he knew. Insane as he might be, he still wasn't going to charge into a pistol pointed at him. He would throw the pry bar. Whoever this man might have been, he was no longer that person. He was enslaved by a nano-web, but also coming apart psychologically under the control mechanism's influence. What she had to do next was an act of mercy, not murder. And if she hesitated to grant him that mercy, he would smash her face, crack her skull. He drew back the iron bar. She shot him in the chest. The bullet convulsed him, but he threw the weapon. Half a second after the first round, the second didn't just tear through his throat. The 45 hollow point removed his throat, took out the spine, so his head wobbled like one of those bobblehead figures that people put on the dashboards of their cars. His empty body collapsed with so little sound that it seemed as if the greater part of his substance had been the mind and soul no longer contained in the package of flesh and bone. His pitch was feeble. The pry bar went wide of her and bounced along the floor. just as the naked woman erupted from the hallway and slashed hard with the butcher knife to cut deep. Chapter 15. Immediately before the crazy person came out of nowhere and the waking nightmare started, Bernie Rigowitz was thinking about the three L's, life, loss, and love. Life is finding people you love and then losing them, sometimes after 60 years, sometimes after a few months or even a week. All the loss meant to keep you humble and remind you that your life is likewise stamped with an expiration date, so that you'll use your days to the best of your ability in the service of what is good. Bernie understood the grand strategy of life's design, and he didn't presume to think that he knew better how it should have been done, but shit, shit, shit. He was fed up with all the losing of people. Bernie, in the Tiffin Allegro cockpit, behind the wheel, was too nervous to do anything other than stare out at the grounds of the RV park, hoping to absorb some of the tranquility from the sun, the majestic palm trees, the glimmering water in the pool. It didn't work. He anxiously checked his wristwatch every 5 or 6 minutes, thinking an hour had gone by. Only 3 times in his life had he come to love someone in mere hours or less. Miriam had always said that she fell in love with him at first sight, and he said he did too, but the truth was that he needed maybe an hour to fall in love with her, but then he fell all the way, and hard. He fell in love with Nasia, his only child, in less than half a minute after his first look at her. What kind of monster didn't love his own baby with every fiber of his being? He'd needed maybe 2 hours to fall in love with Jane, who'd called herself Alice at the time. His love for Miriam involved heart and mind and body, but his love for Jane was a heart and mind thing. In truth, if he'd been 31 instead of 81, and if he'd never met Miriam, this would have been a heart-mind-body thing. But he didn't have it in him to be a dirty old man. If Jane died, Bernie's life of optimism was going to end as a life of despair. And if she lost her boychick, Bernie was damn well after all going to assume that he knew better how the world and life should have been designed. He checked his watch yet again, having expected to hear from Jane by now, certain that 2 hours had passed, that something had gone wrong. But she and Luther had set out from the RV park only a little more than an hour earlier. That was when the crazy person appeared on the deck surrounding the big pool and began to pitch the lounge chairs into the water. Chapter 16. Jane pivoted toward the threat, but the naked woman was too close, coming in as low and fast as a striking snake unraveling from its coils. So damn fast, already past the pistol. The knife slashed right to left across Jane's abdomen, slicing open her t-shirt as if the fabric were gossamer, making a zipper-like sound as it scored the safeguard vest underneath. The body armor featured fine chainmail to protect against edge weapons, plus an underlying Kevlar layer that provided ballistic protection. The vest didn't fail, would never fail, but it was only a vest, leaving points of vulnerability. Face, throat, hands. The attacker had ferocious energy, feral quickness, uncanny strength. Even as the knife sliced across the armor, she body-slammed Jane, driving her back into a wall. A hard shock to the spine. A moment when darkness encroached at the edges of vision. A transient right-side weakness. Jane's right hand opened involuntarily, and the heckler fell with a soft thump on the carpet. Full body contact now. Hand to hand, a death struggle. Jane seized the other's right wrist.